Ms. Salvini?
Your Honors, may it please the court.
Yes.
I represent Frederick McBride in this appeal, and while all the issues that have been raised are important, I don't mean to waive any issues or concede any issues or place any greater importance on one issue as opposed to another, but there are two issues in this appeal that I want to address at this time with the court, and those deal with Mr. McBride's motion to suppress that was heard by the district court. And as the court is aware, there were two aspects to that motion. And the first was that the officers lacked reasonable suspicion to detain his vehicle, and that thereafter, if in fact there was reasonable, articulable suspicion to detain his vehicle, that detention of the vehicle exceeded the limits of the Terry-type stop.
You address the prior bad acts?
I do want to address the prior bad acts, Your Honor, but I want to begin just with the motion to suppress, and I did reserve some time to also address the prior bad act issue as well, which is why I began by stating I don't want to place greater importance on any issue, because I think in this case there are several issues that are of importance, but I do want to address the motion to suppress first, followed by the introduction of the evidence over Mr. McBride's objection at trial. At the outset, the district court considered whether or not the officers had reasonable, articulable suspicion for them to detain constitutionally Mr. McBride's vehicle. And what the court considered is whether or not the officers had articulable facts that criminal activity was afoot, that it was more than a hunch. And then what they looked at is the knowledge of the officers prior to the detention. I think the problem in this case, however, is that we have to define when that detention actually occurred. Because in reviewing the district court's order and its findings, it sort of created this umbrella that I'm going to take the position exceeded when that detention actually occurred. Because as the case law instructs us, that we're limited to what the officers knew, their knowledge prior to that actual detention taking place. The facts in this case are very straightforward. You had officers that observed a nightclub at about 6:15 in the evening, and they saw individuals standing in that parking lot. That's what they saw to begin with. They believed the nightclub had been closed for several months, and they had some knowledge that the nightclub was a place where narcotics transactions occurred in the past. Now, that information may have been stale, and I would submit that it was, since the officers took the position that the nightclub had been closed.
The nightclub was closed, was it not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The nightclub was closed, was it not?
That's the position that the officers did take, Your Honor, that they believed it was closed.
That was the evidence in this case.
I believe
you can't just say it's the position that they took.
I don't believe that there was any evidence that was introduced to the contrary. I agree with that. Right. But it is 6:15 in the evening. We're not talking about them seeing these individuals at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning.
The district court held a hearing and found that the officers actually believed it was closed in the month. It was closed, and it was 6:15, so that's not just the position the officers took, it was the finding the district court made.
That is correct, Your Honor. But what the officers observed is they observed individuals in the parking lot engaging in no illegal activities. What they saw were two or three vehicles leaving the premises. They didn't observe any exchanges between these individuals. And then they saw a Hispanic male with a passenger in his vehicle pull into the parking lot and engage in a very short...
They did observe an exchange.
Well, and that's what I'm coming to, Your Honor, because there was an exchange between a Hispanic male, a driver of a Ford pickup truck, and a black male, and the officers observed this with binoculars. But what they said was there was a short, brief conversation between these two individuals. They approached a black Cadillac, a door was opened, and the testimony was that there was a conversation or an exchange that happened a few seconds, is what the record states. That Hispanic male then went and got back into his vehicle. There was a passenger, and he left. That was it. That's what they saw. They proceeded to then pull those individuals over doing a traffic stop based on a failure of headlights to be turned on. At that time, they learned the driver did not have a driver's license, and the officers looked in the vehicle and saw a large bag of money, which I think is significant because if you look at the totality of the circumstances of what they saw prior to the detention, they saw a huge bag with about $20,000 is what they thought, Your Honors, but it really was only $9,000. So here we have a large sum of money in small denominations, no exchange other than what appeared to be words between two individuals of different races, and that then formed the basis.
What about the $9,100 that was found in the car? I mean, that's just not petty cash.
That's true, Your Honors, but what they didn't see, Judge Wilkinson, is they did not see this black individual and the Hispanic male exchange any money. And it was actually a large sum because they thought it was $20,000, which means that there was a lot of bills and small denominations, and they were observing these individuals with binoculars.
But if you actually, you know, if you have a nightclub that's closed for business, and the district court held a hearing on this, if you have a nightclub that's closed for business, and you have cars coming around at 6:15 in the afternoon, then you have an officer whose experience has to be credited, and he sees a brief exchange, and the fact that it was brief, that doesn't cut in your favor, because obviously these things are often prearranged, and they are brief to be furtive and avoid any kind of detection. And then very shortly thereafter, they find $9,100 in the car. And they didn't even detain him. They didn't even detain the car at that point. That's pretty cumulatively began to seem pretty incriminating to the trial judge that heard the evidence.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, however, that based on the quantity of the money and the fact that it was in a large bag and there was no evidence or testimony that when the officers observed these individuals, the two Hispanic males, they weren't hiding anything. They were never seen furtively putting something in the floorboard.
Well,
there was nothing that was seen walking back in order. There was a large bag.
But $9,100 in cash, and this is very shortly after they observed what appeared to be an exchange, and it was in the same car. I mean, the person with whom the exchange had taken place had gone back to that very car. And we're not talking about probable cause at this point. We're just talking about reasonable suspicion, which is a lesser standard than probable cause. But even then, after they found the $9,100, they entered the club and they found that nobody was engaged in normal activities, such as eating or drinking. At least that's what the district court said. And they testified before the district court that the defendant had been involved in prior drug trafficking activity. And then the defendant says, yeah, that's my car. And even then, they don't search it.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit they didn't search it because they didn't have probable cause to do so at that point.
The only question is whether they... You know, I can tell you an awful lot of law enforcement officers would have thought that they did have probable cause and that there was an automobile exception, but these officers didn't do that. They just detained it. They didn't search it at that point.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit because as this court has held in the past, it although there's not a bright line test of what actually is reasonable suspicion, and even considering the totality of the circumstances, all they have here are two individuals of a different race speaking briefly in a parking lot, a nightclub that is closed, and a few people coming and going. That's all they know. Then they pull over a vehicle for a traffic violation, and yes, they have cash, but the significance is a large sum of money. There was no black bag exchanged between the Hispanic male and the black male, and they make the decision, I would submit to this court, to detain the vehicle right then and there. And in fact, the testimony, the record is that what happens...
That's correct. They went into the nightclub. They found people not engaged in activities that one would normally associate with a nightclub. And the defendant, whom they knew had engaged in prior drug activity, the district court credited that testimony, then said, waved the keys in the officers and said, yeah, it's mine.
That's right, Your Honor. And
even at that point, there was no detention. There was no search.
There wasn't a search, but I would submit to the court that that's when the detention occurred. That officer walked back into the club, and his testimony was the first thing he said was, I want everybody's IDs, and none of these vehicles are leaving. The detention occurred right then and there. And I would submit to this court that the district court considered factors outside of that.
That's not the finding of the district court. The district court said that these were activities that occurred before the detention. And he uses the word before.
And that's why my primary issue before this court is determining whether or not the district court erred in that regard. Because what is happening here...
It's a factual finding.
I agree, Your Honor. It is a factual finding. But what we have here is to make that determination, you have an officer that makes a bright line rule. There's no question. He says at that point, because I could, if that's the position that the court takes, I could argue, arguably, when officers pulled into the parking lot and wouldn't let anybody leave, I would submit that detention occurred there. But if you take the testimony, the officer himself admitted the first thing he did is walk in. He'd already made up his mind he was detaining those vehicles, and that's what he did. He told everybody, I want your IDs, and nobody's leaving. These cars are not leaving. That's exactly what he did. And even then, that's when Mr. McBride said, here's my car.
What happened to the other cars is something the defendant wouldn't have standing to object to. But the he was certainly free to leave.
He was, but his vehicle wasn't, Your Honor, and I would submit that there was not reasonable suspicion for him to do so.
Well, he did walk considerable distance.
He did. He eventually did leave, but his vehicle wasn't permitted to leave. The second issue before Your Honors is whether or not the detention of his vehicle exceeded the bounds and the limits of a reasonable Terry stop, and the district court considered that second issue. With that issue, what happened is that the officers determined that they were going to call a drug dog. That took approximately a little over 55 minutes, an hour, to call to the scene to do a Terry-type investigation.
Well, one of the things you ask here is whether this was unduly or unreasonably prolonged. But it was not, you're talking about Clarendon County. It's not, as far as I know, a major metropolitan county. They didn't have a canine unit. It was not the officer's fault that they didn't have a canine unit. So they called over to Florence, which was the nearest, I guess, locality that did have a canine unit. And the officer was off duty at the time. He immediately shifted into his clothes and got the dog and came over. And what I worry about is that if we reverse the district court and held that this was an unreasonable length of time, then you would encourage officers to take shortcuts, and they would say, "Well, we're not going to bother to get additional evidence or to have canines brought on the scene because the courts are going to return. So just go ahead and search right away." And, that's not what you want them to do. I mean, here they delayed the search. They got a warrant. They didn't just rush in. And if you penalize them for that, you're going to get more impetuous behavior than any of us want.
Your Honor, but there are several factors, and I'm out of time. I'd like to briefly respond just to the court's position on that. There are several factors that this court looks at, not only the duration of the stop and whether or not the police acted diligently and whether or not the detention was unnecessarily prolonged, which I would submit to the court that it was. These officers at 7:20, after they arrested the Hispanic males, made the decision that they were going back to the nightclub to detain the vehicles. It was well-known fact that they did not have a drug dog within that county. They could have called then. In fact, they testified that they did call the local county sheriff, and the drug dog still wasn't called. They arrive at the club at 7:35. They've already detained the vehicles by this point. That drug detection dog wasn't called until 8 p.m. The other important factor for the court to consider is whether or not the officers made it clear how these individuals were going to get their vehicles back, where they would be located. They didn't make that finding, and they did not make that disclosure to any of the individuals. They didn't inform them of that, and that is an aggravating factor for the court to take into consideration.
The district court heard all the evidence, took all that into account. Well, he was well aware of that. And he said, look, they got the canines over as quickly as they could. And bear in mind, that they didn't want to just rush in and search right away, and they wanted to get a warrant, and they wanted to make sure before they got the warrant that they had a full measure of probable cause. You know, if you start wrapping law enforcement officers for that, it's counterproductive, because you want to channel the officer's instincts into caution and not just precipitous searches, and you want them to get warrants. The Supreme Court's made this point over and over and over again. We like warrants. And that's what we were doing.
Well, and I...
Ms. Delaney, when you come back on rebuttal, could you talk about prior bad acts? I mean, that may be your far stronger point. And, you know, particularly our cases of United States versus Johnson and United States versus Hernandez.
All right, I will. Thank you, Your Honors.
Did you have questions you wanted to ask?
No, not even. No, I just want to hear what she has to say about it.
May it please the court. What Mr. McBride was asking the district court to do was to suppress the evidence that was found in his car. Now, the purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter officers from committing misconduct that violates defendants' constitutional rights. But in this case, the officers committed no misconduct. They didn't do anything wrong. They were driving down the road. They saw a situation that looked suspicious to them, and they took incremental steps to address what they were seeing. They parked 0.4 mile away at a public place, watching what was going on. At the time that they saw what they believed might be a drug transaction, they stopped one of the vehicles involved, and then they did find this large sum of cash. And then they go back to the club and walk in and talk to the people who are in the club, and that's when they see Mr. McBride, and they recognize that he has a history of drug dealing, as well as a couple of other individuals who had similar histories. And after accumulating all this information, it was at that point that they took a further incremental step, which was to say, you're free to leave, but we're going to detain the cars long enough to get a drug dog here.
And counsel, then, let me ask this. They didn't see any exchange of anything in the hands of those people, those two people, did they?
They did not.
Okay, so their only suspicion that it may be drug trafficking would have to be based upon that the club was closed and it at one time was a scene of drug trafficking, correct? That's the only two things, really. What else would it have been?
No, I think you're right. They knew that the club had the history. Specifically, mm-hmm. They knew, or they had information that Hispanic males were delivering drugs to the club. They see a Hispanic male meet with a gentleman at the club. They understood that the club had been closed for months and months, and it was a time that even if the club had been open for business, it was not within the club's operating hours.
Okay, all right. And then they stopped the vehicle that left and found $9,100 of money.
Correct.
No drugs.
No drugs.
Okay. Now, when they went in the club, that you think that was enough for them to just say, okay, everybody in the club, only people who have ID can leave. That was just broadcast, said to everyone, because you saw what you believed to be a drug transaction, perhaps, you didn't see any drugs, but because you saw that, you could just walk into the club and say, listen, all of y'all, only the people who showed me ID can leave. Wasn't that a seizure of everyone who didn't have ID?
Well, it was not a seizure of their persons because they
it's
were...
It's not? He said you can't leave if you don't have ID.
Well, I think officers have a right when they encounter people to ask for identification. He specifically told them that they were free to leave.
So you mean if I walked down the street and police officer said, let me see your ID, and I said, well, you know, I left it at home, he could hold me just because I left it at home?
No, but I think at the point that he walked back into the club, he had enough information, he had enough justification to ask to see their identification.
Everybody in the whole place, not just the person who looked like that one African-American who had an encounter with the Hispanic man, but everybody, everyone, black, white, whatever. Because we don't know the race of the other people in the club. All we know is that everybody in the club, if you don't have ID, you cannot leave. Is that correct?
Yes, it's correct that he came into the club and said, I'm going to need to see everyone's ID. It wasn't just Mr. McBride.
And you can't leave if you don't show it to me. That's what he said, correct? That's undisputed.
Right? He said, I think you're right. He said that.
It's in the record. I mean.
I'm not disputing you. Oh. He said that once we see your ID, you're free to leave, but the cars have to stay. That's correct.
We're not talking here about the detention of other people. We're talking here about whether there was reasonable suspicion. We have a discrete question before the court. The other hasn't really been briefed. And it deals with the particular automobile and the detention of the particular automobile in question. There's no standing for a whole host of reasons for this defendant to raise the rights of everybody else in the club. We're not trying to seek to admit any evidence against them or the product of any the fruits of any search or whatever. We're dealing with this particular individual against whom the evidence is sought to be admitted. He doesn't have standing to raise the rights of every other patron.
I would agree with that. At the time that the officer, the district court enumerated a list of things that happened before he was seized. And those facts amount to reasonable suspicion for the officers to have detained him at that point. He does not have standing to contest the seizure of the other individuals.
Well, I don't think that I said he did. I'm asking you, he was one of the persons in the club when he said that to everybody, correct?
He was, yes, sir.
So he is definitely in the scope of that. Not the other people, but I said he said it to everyone, and he was one of them. So he was seized at that point, wasn't he?
Yes, he was seized at the point that the officer said, are you asking if he was seized or if
yes.
The car was seized?
No, was he seized at that point when he said, you can't leave until you show me ID?
It certainly is a type of seizure. If the officer says, you can't go until I get certain information, then certainly it is a seizure of a sort. And I believe that as to him, the officer had enough justification at that point to say, I'd like to see your identification.
All right, and saw that and then took his keys from him.
No, I don't think anyone ever gave keys to the officers.
Didn't give the keys. They didn't get the keys.
They did not get the keys.
Just looked at it and said, but you have to walk home or wherever you want to go because your car is not leaving.
Correct. He said, you're free to leave, but the car has to stay.
Did he tell him when he's going to get the car back? Where and when?
There was not a conversation about that.
So he was just leaving, perhaps never to see his car again or have possession of it.
I would respectfully disagree with that. The testimony was that the defendant represented that it was his club. He had keys to the club that he handed to an individual named Mr. Green and said, you guys can stay here and lock up. I'm going home. And so the vehicle was parked on what appeared to be property that was under his control. It's not like a traffic stop where the car is parked by the side of the road or luggage in an airport where there's some question about what's going to happen to it. Is the car going to be towed? It was on private property, so there wasn't the need for that type of discussion as to how he was going to get the car back.
Well, how would he have known that it wasn't going to be towed?
I don't know what the basis would be for the officers towing it if the dog never alerted. If the dog never alerts, the car stays on the property and the officers leave.
And he was told that? We're going to get a canine unit. You'll get your car back as soon as the dogs don't alert. I don't think the record says
that. No, sir, and I'm not saying that conversation is in the record. My point is that the conversation was unnecessary because there wasn't that lingering uncertainty about what was going to happen to the car. It was on his property.
Oh, I see.
With regard to the bad acts, since nobody's talking about them, I have I've got a lot of problems with the analysis here. It seems to me that we have cases that very squarely say that there has to be a relevance, an established relevance. And here we have, what, 18 months that separated Blanding's statement from these events in question. How do you show that the evidence of the prior drug transaction was relevant to the charged offense? Okay? That's what's required under U.S. v. Johnson and U.S. v. Hernandez.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. How is it relevant?
I think
as opposed to just showing a predisposition to commit criminal activity involving drugs.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the relevance goes to Mr. McBride's intent and to his knowledge. He was charged with possessing the powder cocaine found in the vehicle with the intent to distribute it. He was also charged with possessing the gun in furtherance of drug trafficking. So the evidence that he, on a prior occasion, was known to have the intent and the knowledge of how to convert powder cocaine into crack cocaine for the purpose of resale is relevant to the issue of whether on this occasion he knew what cocaine was, had an intention to distribute it. There is a relevance there as to his state of mind.
In every drug case, it would be relevant to a defendant's state of mind, the fact that the defendant had distributed or had processed drugs or anything else. In every drug prosecution, it seems to me, under your analysis, you could get this evidence in as evidence of his state of mind. And certainly, that's not allowed under Rule 404. So where do you draw the line? Why is this on your side of the line as opposed to the defendant's side of the line?
I think it's on this side of the line because it does go to show that he had the intent to distribute it.
Well, that would be true in every drug case where a defendant had distributed before. If somebody had a prior distribution, 18 months earlier, you'd be up here arguing that that would be enough, right?
I'm not sure that I understand
the question is, how do you apply Rule 404 from your perspective? It seems to me that you're allowing in any prior evidence of a drug distribution or a drug connection, irrespective of its relevance to the transaction in question for which the defendant was convicted. So tell me why, under any circumstances, how any involvement in drug activity under with an 18-month time lag would result in the exclusion of evidence under your analysis. Give me a case where it would be inappropriate with the 18-month time lag with prior drug activity. As I understand it, you're saying it would always be.
I'm not intending to say that. Okay,
could you give me an example then with an 18-month time lag where it would be inappropriate, prior drug transaction as opposed to present drug interaction?
You asked about a case, and I don't believe that it involved an 18-month window. I think the window
was longer. Johnson was 5 years. But we also have Hernandez. Both of these were unanimous decisions of this court, Johnson just last year. It says there has to be a relevance. And you seem to be suggesting, well, it was drugs then, it was cocaine then, it's cocaine now, it's relevant. Well, it seems to me that that's the real evil that the rule is trying to avoid, that you're guilty of this charge just because you did it before.
And I agree that it's a close question. I think you could look at it from the other perspective and say, because there is this potential taint and the jury is going to look at this as once a drug dealer, always a drug dealer, then you could also look at it from the perspective of, this type of evidence should never be admissible. But in this case,
no, sometimes it would be. If there were a question whether this person were manufacturing or processing cocaine on the scene and he had denied knowledge or he had some active role in processing the cocaine to show that he had knowledge of how to do it, the fact he had done it, There, you can come up with a million examples, but I'm asking you to tell me why your position doesn't obliterate Rule 404 in drug cases involving an 18-month separation in time of the incidents in question.
Well, I can say this, and any time the defendant pleads not guilty, he's putting every element of the crime in contest, and one of those elements is whether not only did he possess the drug, but did he possess it with the intent to distribute. And so the fact that he has the knowledge to convert powder cocaine into crack cocaine for the purpose of distribution is relevant to whether he had the intent. I would also point out that the district court did give a limiting instruction here, instructed the jury that they were not to consider the fact that he and that they were only to consider it for the purpose of intent.
Mr. Johnson, let's take a look at Hernandez. In Hernandez, the evidence in question occurred more than 6 months before. Okay, so the Blanding evidence is certainly much more stale than the evidence in Hernandez. In Hernandez, you have a unanimous panel saying that this is it was a violation of the rule. How do you get around Hernandez?
I don't know that I'm able. I'm trying to think about that. But in any event, what I would say is that it is harmless error. That the evidence was overwhelming. And for example, in Johnson was a conspiracy case, and the other evidence in that case, the court found was quite thin, because he was never found to be in possession of drugs. In this case, you know, absent suppression of the evidence, there is no question that he was in possession of a substantial amount of cocaine, along with a firearm, along with cash, and then there was a large amount of cash found in the other vehicles. The evidence that he possessed those drugs with the intent to distribute them is overwhelming, and this gentleman's brief testimony about the events in January of 2008 would not have been so great to overpower the jury's mind as to the evidence that...
Did you argue harmless error? I don't recall that.
We did not argue harmless error specifically in our brief.
Okay, I didn't think
so.
Well,
how can you argue it here then?
But my understanding that under Rule 52, harmless error is something that the court can look at whether it's raised or...
On any ground, but let me mention just a couple things. I mean, we're here again. The standards of review matter tremendously, and we're working here under an abuse of discretion standard, are we not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that gives even if we might not have admitted the evidence in the first instance, the trial court might still have admitted it without being guilty of an abuse of discretion.
Yes,
and
sir.
As you point out here, the trial court was aware of the intent of Rule 404B, and he gave a limiting instruction to the jury to make sure that the evidence wasn't taken as general evidence of criminal predisposition. He went the extra mile to instruct the jury that it can't be admitted, just it has to be admitted for certain specific purposes here, knowledge and intent. And we've often said in these cases, too, that the reliability of evidence is a matter of weight and not admissibility. Jurors are free to take that 18-month period and say, wait, no, that's too far back. And counsel is free to take that 18-month period and say this should be accorded no probative weight at all, because it's too far back. But I think that our cases have always drawn a distinction between weight and admissibility, and have permitted a district judge to operate as he's the manager of the trial, and he has some discretion over which evidence is admitted. And if you reverse a district judge under abuse of discretion,
You say it can never admit it, no matter what. Whereas you have uphold a district judge, you give discretion in future cases to exclude the evidence or admit it as the facts of the case may seem fit. So the more flexible course, which allows for differences in facts and circumstances, is to allow the manager of the trial the discretion that anybody must have. I mean, we've approved cases where the evidence was much more stale than this. Much more. And there may be instances where there were prior cases involving drugs, but they may have involved different drugs. Or they may have involved lesser amounts. Or they may have involved less circumstances which weren't revelatory of knowledge or intent. There are all kinds of situations where the evidence would present would be weaker in terms of 404B than this evidence was. But all of these factors, it seems to me the standard of review is simply a matter of respect for the role trial judges play in the system. And as I say, this judge went out of his way to give a limiting instruction here. And as you point out, we can, at the end of the day, affirm a trial court on any basis, and the evidence here was pretty darn strong. But I don't know that I would have admitted the evidence. All I can say is the trial court has to have some leeway, some. Not infinite, but a bit. Anyway, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, ma'am, you have some rebuttal time.
Your Honors, I began my opening statement by stating that I did not mean to give one issue more weight than another, because I do believe there's several issues that have to be considered by this court and this appeal, and one of them, as addressed by Judge Keenan, is this 404B issue that we have. And while I understand that trial judges should be given some leeway in making their decisions as to whether or not to admit or exclude evidence, it's this court that gives them the guidance on how to do that. And in this case, what you had is you had an 18-month-old transaction that became the center of this trial. And it was a transaction that occurred.
This person also, one of the points that goes to reliability, is there's no question of identity here. The Blanding said he had known the defendant since middle school, since the time of middle school. It might be a different case if somebody didn't, if there was a question of identity and the district judge says, no, you don't have the past history or with this person. I'm not even sure you've got the right one. But one of the factors that goes to reliability and that I think distinguishes it or brings it within the grounds of a district court discretion is that this individual knew the person from middle school. It wasn't an identity problem here. It wasn't questionable in that aspect of it.
Likewise, Judge, though, but if that would mean if the court finds and holds that, then anybody that knows me, for example, and I'm on trial for something that says I've known Jessica Salvini since I was 5 years old, right, and let me tell you all the bad things that she used to do,
that's not
that would
all.
Then to
that's,
imitate
that's
that.
That's not
would,
all. We're not talking about 5 years old, but further, speaking to the reliability of the evidence, in this instance, there were video and audio recording devices when the purchase of the drugs was made from the defendants. It's a different case, perhaps, if there weren't video and audio recording devices. But the district judge looks at the evidence He says, okay, they've known each other since middle school. I don't have a problem with identity. And when the drug transaction, when the drug purchase was consummated, there were video and audio recording devices on it. Surely that enhances reliability, does it not? And then finally, as an extra precautionary step, you get a limiting instruction on it. And the rule does allow things that go to a knowledge and intent case. And in this case, knowledge and intent were issues. And why not let a jury assign what weight it will to the evidence? They're perfectly free to discount it altogether. They've got an instruction saying what they have to use it for.
Your Honor, but it has to be relevant. And I know that the court is looking at the knowledge and intent. However, that would be true of every drug case. The government is relying simply on the fact that because an individual pleads not guilty, that now knowledge and intent are at issue, and so therefore they should be able to bring in any drug transaction.
No, that's not. That's way too broad.
But that's what happened.
As I point out, the limiting factors here are the length of time they had known each other and the fact that a video and audio recording device were worn when the previous transaction took place. And that, you know, it's a very good question. Does this allow just anything to come in? Not necessarily, no.
But we're talking about a different drug, Your Honors. We're talking about cooking crack cocaine. What happened in this trial is you have a possession with intent to distribute cocaine. Crack cocaine has been distinguished. And
sure,
we go into a whole testimony about this is how he cooks it. Now, are you going to have it ready? That has nothing to do with this case.
Wait a minute. You can make that argument. Nobody's taking that argument away from you. You can make that argument in close. You can make that argument over and over. You can make that argument on cross-examination. You can impeach with that argument. You can make that argument at close, and a jury may well take you up on it. But
Your
what
Honor,
you do is you don't even let the jury hear it, even under a cautionary instruction, when you reverse a district court for abuse of discretion.
And that's, I would submit in this...
That's bringing a very fine district judge up very sharply.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. What you're doing is you're providing the district court with guidance, because what's occurring in these cases is you can't unring the bell once the jury hears it. I understand that the precedent says a limiting instruction should be taken into consideration when determining whether or not the district court should have admitted the evidence of whether or not there was prejudice to this defendant. But what you have here is a trial that involves a vehicle at a nightclub 18 months later that has some cocaine, money, and a gun in it. And then we hear testimony during a majority of this trial about a middle school classmate who went over to his house wearing a wire to talk about cooking crack cocaine. The case law, the precedent that's been established by this court, designates or instructs the court it has to be relevant. It also has to maybe potentially have to be able to tell the whole story of the crime here. This is not the crime. The crime is not possession with crack cocaine and how to cook it and whether or not he intended to cook this cocaine and make it into crack. That was the implication, though.
The court's precedent give broad latitude to trial judges to make evidentiary judgment calls. That's what they do for a living. It's what they do day after day after day.
But they have to have some guidance as to whether or not certain prior bad acts should
be
admitted.
They have the guidance, and then they apply it.
But in this case, Your Honor, what happened is a transaction that occurred 18 months earlier between an individual who wasn't even present at the nightclub regarding cooking crack cocaine was presented to the jury in detail, including playing a video, audio of the transaction to basically say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what you have here is a narcotics dealer. He cooks cocaine. He sells crack in your neighborhood and in your community. You need to convict him. That's essentially what they heard. Even though the judge gave a limiting instruction saying you're not supposed to consider that as to whether or not he possessed cocaine with the intent to distribute on August 2009.
What you're putting a gloss on what they heard. They heard what took place.
In addition to a prior act that was 18 months old, Your Honors, that should have never been admitted at the trial. It was a prior bad act that's excluded specifically.
There are many cases out there that have admitted acts, including from this circuit, before 18 months, with a longer period than 18 months.
Yes, but the recent decisions by this court is to caution the district court on the introduction of every prior bad act in a drug case that involves a drug transaction, because that's what's been occurring at the trial court level. The jury is hearing evidence that should be excluded by the rules of evidence, specifically Rule 404B, that excludes assassinating somebody's character. What ends up happening is that the jury is being permitted to consider prior drug transactions, whether they're related or not, whether they are similar type of drug or not. And in this case, it wasn't even the same type of drug to prove knowledge and intent.
You can argue that they're not related.
And what this court has held, though, that it has to be relevant.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We will come down and greet counsel. I want to thank you. You're court appointed, I say, and I appreciate very much your services. We'll come down and greet counsel and proceed into our final case.